I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness,
because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Psych Legal Pop podcast. This is a podcast where we talk about popular culture through the lens of an attorney and a therapist. I'm Brooke Brigham. I'm the attorney.
And I'm Tess Brigham. I'm the therapist.
And today is our second installment in what we're calling, what, Mendocino County stories?
Yes. Stories of our childhood.
Yes. So we're doing episodes on things that happened in or around, the town of Ukiah, Mendocino County in general in Northern California, where we are from. And this is a big one. Today we're talking about Jim Jones and the People's Temple.
Yes.
And I think most people know about this. This is one of the biggest cults in, in American history. And, actually when the followers, like almost 1,000 followers died in Jonestown, Guyana in 1978. And it was at that time the largest casualty of American citizens until 9/11.
Yes. I read that, which is crazy.
Yeah. It was a lot, and it was a crazy time, and there was a lot going on. And we're going to talk about it all, but also we're going to talk about our personal connection that we have to this, because both of our parents, or people attempted to recruit them.
Yes, people wanted our parents. That could have been us. That could have been us.
And our father has an even closer connection, which we'll get into.
Yeah.
Jim Jones was actually part of a team who hired him to come to Mendocino County, to Ukiah, to be the director of legal aid. So we have lots to talk about, lots to get into. But first, Tess is going to give a very high level synopsis of the People's Temple story.
Yes, hopefully I can make it high level because there's so much material here. But James Warren Jones was born May 13th, 1931, and he was an American cult leader and mass murderer who led the People's Temple between 1955 and 1978. In what he termed revolutionary suicide, Jones and the members of his inner circle planned and orchestrated a mass murder-suicide in his remote jungle commune at Jonestown, Guyana, on November 18th, 1978. That's also the day that Jones died. Jones and the events that occurred at Jonestown have become a defining influence on society's perception of cults. Jones founded the organization that would become the People's Temple in Indianapolis, Indiana in 1955. In 1965, Jones moved the temple to California. The group established its headquarters in San Francisco, where he became heavily involved in political and charitable activity throughout the 1970s. Jones developed connections with prominent California politicians and was appointed as chairman of the San Francisco Housing Authority Commission in 1975. So Jones was born in Crete, Indiana. His father was a disabled World War I vet. So because of that, his illness led to a lot of financial difficulties. Jones grew up in a shack with no plumbing or electricity. They often had inadequate food and relied on financial support from their family. Jim Jones's mother was described as having no natural maternal instincts, and she frequently neglected her son. So between his mom and his dad, he was really neglected by both of his parents. And what was reported was that he became this very unusual child who became obsessed with religion and death. And so he really did not make a lot of friends. His parents eventually divorced and they moved. He eventually graduated from high school in Richmond, Indiana. He then got a job after school before he started college, where he met a nurse in training, Marceline May Baldwin, who he later married in 1949. He graduated from college in 1951 with an education degree. And it was during this time that he started to become heavily influenced by the Later Rain movement, which was associated with the Independent Assemblies of God, and really got involved in the teachings of William Branham. So a lot of Branham's material was about how, you know, there's this doomsday, that there was this coming, that the world was going to end. And Jones also got and like sort of took on this same stance and believed that as well. And that's when he first started traveling to South America, which is also what Branham was doing, is traveling, trying to move his congregation to South America. But what happened was that he in 1963, in the early 60s, he went first to Guyana and these areas to look at it, trying to see if he can set things up. Things started to fall apart at the People's Temple back in Indiana. So he had to return. And so basically he told everyone, hey, you know, we're going to be engulfed in a nuclear war on July 15th, 1967. So we need to move our temple to Northern California for safety. So they ended up moving to the Ukiah area, Redwood Valley, which is right outside of Ukiah. It's during this time that Jones becomes even more powerful. He begins to, becomes part of the politics of San Francisco. So he is played an instrumental role. He and the People's Temple played an instrumental role in George Moscone being elected as mayor. There was also Assemblyman at the time, Willie Brown, who later became mayor of San Francisco, served as master of ceremonies at a big dinner that was attended by Governor Jerry Brown. And he was also connected to vice presidential candidate Walter Mondale and Rosalynn Carter and Jimmy Carter, who all, once everything came out, they all distanced themselves. But it was also during this time that Jones began to receive negative press. Things started to come out about various things. One was about Jones's quackery and the fact that he could claim that he could heal people from cancer. Stories started to come out about what was happening with the members of the People's Temple, and we can get more into that, of them having to give over all of their assets to Jim Jones in order to remain as part of the temple. And then everything starts to, I'm going to fast forward a bit. In 1978, they started, right before then, they started moving more and more people over to Guyana. So the temple could, basically, they were going to reform the People's Temple in Guyana. And in 1978, Congressman Leo Ryan led a fact-finding mission to Jonestown to investigate allegations of human rights abuses. So he flew in with his team, an NBC camera crew, and reporters from several newspapers. They were arrived in Georgetown on November 15th. 2 days later, they traveled by plane to the to Jonestown. And at the time, one of the temple members slipped a note to an NBC reporter saying, "We want to go. We want to get out of here." So Ryan and the group took some supporters with, and Jim Jones let them go. And what happened was that on November 18th, they left in a hurry, Ryan and his delegation, the group members that wanted to leave the area and the reporters all left. And when they tried to board the plane, a group of militants of Jim Jones attacked the crew. And Ryan later died. And then at that same time, Marceline Jones, the wife, she made an announcement over this loudspeaker at Jonestown and told them that it was time to go. And so they had been shipping in cyanide. And so they had these large metal tubs of cyanide, and they made this grape flavored Kool-Aid with diazepam and cyanide and all of these other drugs. So that same day, basically, when Jones heard that the security guards failed to kill all of Ryan's party, Leo Ryan party, Jones concluded the escapees would soon inform the United States of the attack and they would send the military to seize Jonestown. So Jones called the entire community and said, "Okay, well, we're going to commit revolutionary suicide." A drink mixture of Flavor Aid and cyanide was handed out to all the members of the community to drink. Those who refused to drink were injected with cyanide via syringe. So essentially there was this, either die by poison or death by a guard's hand. The mass murder-suicide resulted in the deaths of 909 inhabitants of Jonestown, 267 of them children, mostly in and around the pavilion. And Brooks said that this was the biggest act of loss until 9/11. So the Guyani military arrived in Jonestown to find all of these dead. They found Jones himself dead at the center of the pavilion. He was resting on a pillow near his deck chair with a gunshot wound in his head. The official autopsy in December of 1978 confirmed that Jones' cause of death was suicide. So those are the broad strokes. And I even eliminated, I can't tell you how much stuff I eliminated.
Yeah, the man did have quite a prolific life.
Yes, yes.
He did a lot of... Towards the end, a lot of bad things. I think, there were some good things about him, but I don't know, because, on the outside, yeah, he was very much speaking out against racism and trying to make his church a integrated church. Mm-hmm. And, a lot of people from the LGBTQ community were welcomed in, but then you hear these stories of what was kind of happening behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. So for a long time, I feel like he was riding on some good press and like, look, all these people, all these San Francisco mucky mucks think he's great.
Yeah.
And then you got, and the Carters and Walter Mondale. I mean, he like bamboozled some people.
Yeah. I mean, back in Indianapolis, one thing was that his father was in the KKK and mm-hmm. he fought with his father a lot over these civil rights issues. And so he was, I'm looking through my notes here, but it was said that he did a lot for, civil rights in the area of in the Midwest in Indiana, because he was given these, you know, roles where he really went in there and he started trying to change things. There was a story in there about how like he got sick at one point, and so he was quote unquote accidentally though put into the black ward of the hospital, and he refused to leave. And, you know, he apparently did a lot of things that a lot of people felt like he really was trying to change things. Now, at the same time,
yeah, lest people think we're here defending
him. Yeah, we're not defending him. At the same time, it was also revealed that he would target the black communities and target them. So that's the thing, right? Like, what was his true motivations for doing these things?
Right. Because also, once you get into the cult, no matter what color you are, the same rules apply to everyone. Everyone has to, like, give Jones their paycheck, mm-hmm. you know, turn over all their assets to him. You know, because when they move to Redwood Valley, you know, it was a commune, and people were working on the, you know, working on the commune,
yeah.
and working, you know, planting gardens and doing this. And they would work very hard, very long hours. And some of them had, in addition, jobs outside of that.
Yes.
That they would go to. And so all this, and then, so they would turn over everything and do all this in exchange for room and board.
Yes. And and probably spiritual teachings.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, all of that. There was some strange stuff with Jones's views about sexuality. This was in a documentary that I don't know if it was an A&E documentary or one of these documentaries I saw. Basically, they had these former members talking about how Jones believed that everyone in the world was gay except for him.
Oh.
Like, all men were gay, all women were gay. He was not. And if people chose to have not, you know, relationships that were not gay relationships, then they were just overcompensating.
Oh, interesting.
And also in this same documentary, they have these men talking about how Jones would tell them, not to be too graphic here, but like he would say to them, you know, when they joined the church, he'd say things like, well, if you ever want me to have sex with you, just let me know.
You know, just FYI.
FYI.
I'll fit it in.
If it's something you want to do.
Yeah, my schedule here. Yeah.
Yeah. So there was, but then there was reports of Jones sleeping with all of these women, and he had, you know, children with all these different women who were in the church with. I don't know. So there was really crazy stuff going on behind the scenes, but he kept up for quite a while, like a fairly good reputation.
Something,
you know, in public.
Yeah. I mean, you know, reading about his early childhood, I mean, he has sort of the classic signs. He was killing animals very young. He was fascinated by death. He would do really, you know, really disturbing things. Everybody, you know, people, the sense that I get is like people felt sorry for him, but they were also kind of afraid of him.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I would love to have known more about his wife. Like, what was, you know, what was going on with her? Or what was she thinking about all of this stuff? Because she was like second in command. She was running things in Jonestown. Like, because he started to, apparently when he came to California, he really started to use drugs, like heavy duty, and mainly like barbiturates. And he was, you know, heavily, heavily addicted to heroin, or what was it? He was addicted to phenobarbital at the end of his life. So when he died, they found a very high amount of it in his system. So he started using drugs and then that made him even more paranoid and suspicious of people. And yeah, it was interesting, because one of the things that they said was that, you know, when they got up to Ukiah, I think he also realized like, oh gosh, it's kind of limited here. Like, I don't have a lot of people to recruit from because this isn't a huge city. So that's when I guess he moved to Northern California, got himself established, it sounds like, in Ukiah, Redwood Valley, and then came down to San Francisco and started mm-hmm. becoming established there. Like, okay, we need to put our headquarters here in San Francisco because this is yeah. where everybody is. And then there were other branches all over the place.
Yeah. So yeah, the 1965 moved to California. I think that's when they moved, you know, initially to Ukiah. I don't know what year they moved the headquarters, but anyway, yeah, you're right, because there's only so many people up there you can yeah. recruit. And so our dad said he knew that Jim Jones was full of shit mm-hmm. the first time he met him. But like I said, you know, Jim Jones was on the board of directors for the Mendocino County Legal Aid Foundation because, you know, he was, you know, trying to be a do-gooder, or at least look like he was a do-gooder. And so the board of the Legal Aid Foundation, they hired our dad to be the director. And so our dad had to go to board meetings with him and, you know, had contact, but he did not work there for very long.
Yeah. Like, he said, what, 15 months?
Yeah.
Yeah.
15 months. But yeah, he said, you know, Jim Jones always acted very self-important and, you know, he could tell he was full of shit. And there was some other guy on the board who was part of the People's Temple who, you know, asked him to come to a service, you know, at the church. Mm-hmm.
Was that the Stowen guy?
No.
Okay.
Tim
Stowen's a whole other separate story.
Yeah, but
yeah, we'll keep going. Him. Yeah.
But yeah, he was the predecessor, I think, our dad's predecessor. He was the director of legal aid before. And then he started moving up in the ranks because he was part of the People's Temple, started moving up in the ranks mm-hmm. for that. But yeah, it was a very big part of the community. And so our family moved there in like 1971, kind of towards the end of the time, because I think by 72 or 73, somewhere around there, I think he may have, you know, been out of there.
Mm. No. Keep going. Let me look it up.
So anyway, there's so much here. I'm not quite sure where to go next, but,
let's go over to I don't know. I the whole his childhood and all of that's so interesting because, you know, he really got he definitely, it sounds like, was this voracious reader and was really, you know, I'm always fascinated like how these cult leaders come up with their ideas. Right. And so, you know, I was reading, like, he would read about, you know, Hitler, and he would read about, you know, Gandhi, and he would read about, like, he read about all these various figures, Stalin, and it really sounds like, and that's the part that I always was wondering about. I'm like, were you gathering all this information and believing it and taking it in as if it's the truth? Or are you like, you know, I think I can do this. I think I can create a church. I think I can create something more here. And okay, great. This is my platform. I'm going to believe in this, and I'm going to believe in this. I'm going to believe in this. I'm going to believe in this. And let me mush it all together. Here I go. And because it sounds like this was very early on. If you hear about his life, it was almost like, what else would he do with his life but this? Because it seems like he was obsessed with religion very early on. And one of the things that I was reading was that apparently, you know, this woman that was part of this church took pity on him and, you know, started bringing him to church. And so I don't know if it was like this connection with this woman that he meets and she, you know, gives him this warmth that he never had from his parents. Because he says very early on he had a lot of anger inside of him.
Yeah. Like a lot of things I read too were saying, like, people are questioning, does he really believe this? Mm-hmm. You know, does he believe what he's saying? 'Cause he also changed what he was saying a lot. You know, it was, he would just kind of move from one theory to the next, you know, because when the nuclear war didn't happen in 1967, then, you know, you have to come up with something else. Okay, what's our next thing? But yeah, he definitely preyed on people, preyed on vulnerable people, preyed on, you know, people's insecurities and
paranoia. The other thing too, is which I think helped the movement and helped him get members too, was the fact that at that time in San Francisco, there was a lot of political unrest. This is the late 60s, early 70s, right? Mm-hmm. So you go to Northern, and maybe this is why he picked Northern California. So when he came into Northern California, you know, people were already primed. People were already feeling disheartened by the world. The Vietnam War was happening. You know, there was the women's
assassinations of MLK and
Kennedy. And yeah, so people were already in that state. So he came in, and I think that all it took was for him to like pony up and not pony up, but like saddle up to and get comfortable with some of these political people. And they sort of signed off on him without really doing, sounds like, much due diligence at all on this guy. And basically, you know, he was able to appeal to these people who were already feeling like the world isn't working. You know, this isn't, you know, I don't like this. And to convince them, like, yeah, come, your life will be so much better. Come with me. Come up to this golden place we call Mendocino County. And, you know, I'll show you Redwood Valley. And here you go. And that also, I think, helped him. The timing of things helped him tremendously.
Right. And he must have been very charming to charm all these people.
Yeah.
He charmed all these San Francisco people. And Harvey Milk, he says Harvey Milk spoke to, so Harvey Milk was the first openly gay politician, in California, probably in the country. Mm-hmm. He was on the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. And he went up to Ukiah, spoke to at the temple with some during a political rally, and afterwards wrote to Jones and said, "Reverend Jim, it may take me many a day to come back down from the high that I reached today. I found something dear today. I found a sense of being that makes up for all the hours and energy placed in a fight. I found what you wanted me to find. I shall be back, for I can never leave." It's like, what? Uh-huh. After one afternoon, and you got
it. It must have been a good
sermon. Yeah.
Must have been great.
Yeah. No, he really knew how to work it.
Yeah.
And he really, really kept that going for quite a long time.
But I guess I wonder how that happened, because he was so, everybody in the neighborhood found him, like, growing up, he was really kind of creepy. Like, he had no social skills. People were kind of grossed out by him. So, you know, or almost like worried about him. And so where did you become, or did you, that's why I just feel like I get the sense that he really had this, like, we've talked about this before with serial killers, right? They always have weird relationships with their mothers. Mm-hmm. And he has that classic story of this absent father who couldn't really be a protector, to a mom that treated him poorly. It sounds like really not very nice,
cold
and mean. And he already had this instinct of wanting to hurt things and hurt people and all of this anger. I wonder, like, what those years of high school and college and meeting your now wife, like, did you just sort of figure out, or did you start to study some of these preachers? Mm-hmm. I mean, he must have seen these preachers as being like, this is my way. I can finally feel special and important. And
right. You get adoration and attention and all the stuff that he never had.
So from his parents, and wanting a family, right? Because a lot of his biographers theorize that that's why he created this, was that he always wanted a family, and that this was his way of being in this family. But it's a real effed up family.
So, you know, reports of, you know, abuses mm-hmm. in the church, you know, started to come out. He established what he called a planning commission made up of his lieutenants to direct the People's Temple's communal lifestyle. And through that planning commission, he started controlling all aspects of the lives of his followers. Like I said, members of the temple had to turn over all their assets to the church in exchange for free room and board. Members that worked outside of the temple turned over their income to be used for the benefit of the community. So here's where the real controlling cult stuff starts coming mm-hmm. in. You know, we got these, get people in, you know, classic, this is how it works. And then, but then there started to be some cracks. So what year is this? One of the main characters and one of the people who really led to, I don't want to say that like this is his fault, but like his actions kind of led to what the ultimate conclusion, what happened in Guyana. So there was this lawyer named Tim Stone. I don't know if it's Stone or Stowen, but he was one of Jim Jones's lieutenants, basically. Mm-hmm. He was the guy who worked at Legal Aid. And I have to
say, Dad had a lot of interactions with this guy. A lot, you know, didn't he? I felt like Dad knew him a lot better than he knew Jim Jones, for sure.
Yeah, they had a lot more contact. And because of the Legal Aid connection. And, you know, I think he was maybe still on the board of directors and or maybe got on the board. I don't know. But just kind of as a side note, I remember, okay, so when I was in high school, my high school had this assembly. I don't know if it was just one day or multiple days. It seemed like it went on forever. And I really understand what the theme or the point of it was, but it was basically like trying to warn us about all the bad things in the world.
Ukiah, I remember a lot of those assemblies. That's so the 80s. It's so the 80s.
It really is. So we started out with, okay, so yeah, this is like 1985. The AIDS crisis is happening. So someone comes in, some doctor comes in and basically tells us how awful AIDS, and they were just calling it AIDS. They weren't even distinguishing HIV virus from AIDS. You know what I mean?
We didn't know much. Did we know about that yet? Oh, okay. Yeah.
I don't know. But basically the message was like, you're all, if you have sex, you're going to get AIDS and you're going to die.
Yes.
Literally. I'm not joking.
No, I remember these. I remember the Ukiah assemblies. Wait, can we back up even further? Because I remember being in grade school, like in, I left Ukiah before I, you know, at 10. So, I mean, I was 7, 8, 9, right? They would have, people coming in who about smoking and mm-hmm. chewing tobacco mm-hmm. and like giving us, and they would have like older kids like come and show us like sores that they had in their mouths from chewing tobacco. And because this was the, you know, this was right about 1980, 1981, and this is when things started to the smoking, people were like, oh wait, smoking might be bad. Because people were freely smoking in the 70s.
Can I tell you, I started high school in 1983. We had a smoking section.
No, yeah, I can believe it.
A student smoking mm-hmm. section. I think they closed it like my senior year. But yeah, minors, you know, would do, in between classes at lunch, just go to the smoking section.
Yeah. So, but then they would come to us and come and like say, don't start. Yeah.
Don't be like these high schoolers. they're too far gone. We can't do anything about them. But you guys, please don't start smoking. Psych Legal Pop will be right back after these messages.
Hey there, it's Tess Brigham, the therapist half of Psych Legal Pop. In addition to being a therapist, I'm also a coach, speaker, and author. And if you go to my website, you'll find courses, ebooks, and worksheets for sale. If you're feeling a bit lost, overwhelmed by life's twists and turns, or you're just simply stuck, I've got you covered. Head over to my website, www.tessbrigham.com, for courses, ebooks, and worksheets tailored to help you unlock your true potential. From relationship struggles to career transitions, I'm here to guide you every step of the way. So stop looking outside of yourself at friends, family, social media for the answers. The answers to all your questions are inside of you. My products and services are the first step in uncovering your true you.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
But I remember going to you and telling you these stories, and you and all your friends were like, oh, that's ridiculous. That's not going to happen that quickly. You guys were like, why are they trying to scare you? Like being all cool, like you can still smoke. You'll be fine.
Yeah. So there was scare. And they always do like someone comes in and talks about
say no to drugs. Driving,
say no to
stranger danger.
Right. Kidnapping. Beware of kidnapping.
But you know what? They would also talk to us about that because during that time, too, those were the years where we were constantly fundraising. Remember selling candy, selling wrapping paper. Mm-hmm. I know kids still have to do this today. But like back then, I mean, I remember pounding the pavement, you know, like always like neighbor to neighbor to neighbor. And that was a big thing. The big stranger danger was like, yeah, when you're trying to sell your candy to make money for the school. Make sure don't go into anyone's house.
Don't go inside.
Don't go inside. Get the money outside on the porch, little girl. I was like, and can you remember? I was seven, eight, 9 years old, going from house to house to house, selling stuff on my own,
by myself.
And Dad still laughs about it to this day. He's like, you were out there like selling, and you were quite the sale, like out there. But I was like, did anyone come with me? Was anyone with me? I was just out wandering around the streets,
working.
Yeah. It was crazy. Yeah.
Well, I don't know how this came about, but at this, you know, danger assembly, one of the speakers was Tim Stone. Mm.
The danger of cults.
Yes, exactly. The danger of cults. Don't join a cult. Let me tell you what happened to me.
And the worst thing, his story was terrible.
Yeah. So basically what happened was he and his wife, joined the People's Temple, and I read this somewhere else, but he said that he and his wife basically had an open relationship. Mm. And that, you know, Jim Jones did sleep with women
and men.
He slept with both. And so she got pregnant and had a baby, and then 2 weeks after the baby was born, And you know, there's a birth certificate with their names on it, and you know. But 2 weeks later, Tim Stone signs an affidavit basically saying that Jim Jones is the biological father of this baby. Why? I still don't really know. I can't quite figure that out. And so he and his wife, Tim and the wife, they raised the baby for about 2 years. And then something happens. Then the baby starts living like with Jim and his wife and whoever's living with him. And then he and the wife get divorced. And then he kind of starts. That's when he starts having trouble with the cult. he's questioning this.
Mm-hmm.
Because he doesn't have custody of his son. And it's even though he's on the birth certificate, but he signed this stupid affidavit. I don't know. But yeah, he came in and told us that whole story. And spoiler alert, the son, who was not very old, so the son would have been born like, I think the son was only like maybe six, died in Jonestown.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And so then he and his ex-wife, they teamed up together to try to get custody of the child back. But of course, you're going up against Jim Jones, mm-hmm. you know. So anyway, that was my introduction to this guy.
And but typical 80s fashion, there's no like, should we be giving this to children whose brains aren't fully formed yet? Should we, maybe this might disturb them in some way, shape or form? No, yeah. let's just
give it
all out to there to them and let them figure out how they're going to process it on their own.
No, I'm telling you, when I say that I thought that I was going to die from AIDS, you know, every time I had sex for a long time, that is not an exaggeration.
No. I mean, it really, that was the teaching. The teaching was this whole thing of the just say no, just as if that is going to stop people from procreating. If that's going to stop people from doing drugs, and if that's going to stop people from having sex. Like,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Doesn't work that way.
Support. And apparently this Tim is still alive, right? Dad said that he's still alive and he's still up in Ukiah, but maybe not practicing.
I don't know. I think he's a couple of years older than Dad. Okay. He's probably retired. I mean, he was a lawyer. He worked in the district attorney's office and the public defender's office. He had worked kind of all over the place and eventually ended up back in Ukiah after all of this. Well, he was a defector, mm-hmm. basically. And the custody battle that he and his ex-wife were waging against Jim Jones kind of triggered a chain of events
which
led Leo Ryan, who was the congressman at the time, the 11th district, Nancy Pelosi's district in San Francisco, you know, and also he formed this group called Concerned Relatives.
Yes, yes.
So around this time, a lot of relatives of the Temple members were getting concerned, mm-hmm. you know, rightly so. So they started getting together and they started trying to do something. So they went to Congressman Ryan and, you know, told him that, you know, there's these people, they're taking them to Guyana and the people can't leave and they're being held against their will. And there's all these abuses going on and whatnot. And that's what started the ball rolling on that.
Yeah, it was the autumn. I have it here. The autumn of 1977, Tim Stowen and other Temple defectors formed a Concerned Relatives group because they had family members in Jonestown who were not being permitted to return to the United States. Stowen traveled to Washington, D.C. in January of 1978 to visit the State Department officials and members of Congress. He wrote a white paper detailing his grievances against Jones and the Temple and his attempt to recover his son. His efforts aroused the curiosity of California Congressman Leo Ryan, who wrote a letter on Stowen's behalf to Guyanese Prime Minister Forbes Burnham. The Concerned Relatives began a legal battle with the Temple over the custody of Stowen's son. So it was, and it was also this paranoia, right? So because all of this was happening and Jones knew Stowen was coming for him and like, oh my God, now you're going to Washington, D.C. Now you're getting political figures. That's when this paranoia started to really get worse and worse. And he's obviously still using drugs. And the other thing with Jonestown was that like the place wasn't really set up properly, right? So they were trying to create this new community and apparently like they, 50 people went over in the beginning of 1977 that then another 600 more came over in the summer of 1977. And the people there were, they didn't have the infrastructure. They didn't have stuff set up that the...
Yeah, because this very remote.
Yeah.
It's a very in a very remote place. Like it's hard to get to. There's no services or...
Yeah, I mean, it took right when Leo Ryan and the group went there, they flew in to Georgetown, and then they had to fly and take another plane over to where they where this group was. So, and apparently the people, you know, they were working all day long, being fed very little, and all of this, and not being able to sleep. And a lot of this, Jones knew what he was doing. He wanted to keep them, like, let's keep them, let's not feed them so that they're weak. Let's keep them sleep deprived so they can't make decisions. Everyone was in this weakened state, while at the same time, Jim Jones was eating, you know, anything he wanted and getting all the drugs he wanted and all that other kind of stuff. So there was there was tons of money. I mean, he had something like $20 million there.
Wow.
At the, I think by today's standards, $20 million. I have to look at the numbers, but yeah.
Well, so Stone actually got, in 1977, he got an order from a San Francisco court granting custody of the boy, his name is John, to his mother, Grace. The court order meant that Jones could not return to the U.S. without facing contempt proceedings for failing to turn over the child. It also meant Jones could never let the child leave Jonestown. In January 1978, Stone traveled to Georgetown in an unsuccessful bid to take custody of the child. While at the airport, three Temple members surrounded Stone and threatened his life unless he dropped his legal action. Although Stone wanted to travel to Jonestown to retrieve John, he thought, if I went back, I thought I would probably be a corpse within 30 days.
Wow.
So then that's when he returned. He went to Washington, D.C., visited with nine members of Congress, including Leo Ryan, and the Temple sent members to visit eight of the nine congressmen in order to discredit Stone. And at the end of January 1978, Stone and fellow concerned relative Stephen Katsaris met with the State Department officials, insisting that Jones' mental condition was deteriorating and that he was suffering from paranoid megalomania. Stone urged that the State Department move Guyana to speedily enforce the custody order that the Stones had won. So the pressure is coming down. So let's see, when did they actually leave? Okay, so the final trip. So by October 1978, all of the defectors had allied with Stone and the concerned relatives. On October 3rd, Stone told the State Department that he would retrieve his son John from Jonestown by force if necessary. 3 days later, he sent a telegram reiterating the threat and warning of the danger of mass suicide. As pressure grew, the Temple learned that Stone would accompany an investigatory trip by Representative Ryan to Guyana. On November 15th, both Grace and Tim Stone traveled with the Ryan delegation to Georgetown. However, they were not permitted to accompany the delegation on its trip to Jonestown on November 17th. So they had to stay in Georgetown. And then that delegation, which was like Leo Ryan and his assistant at the time, Jackie Speer, who's now a congresswoman.
Mm-hmm.
And then a bunch of news reporters were with them. So while the Stones remained in Georgetown, the Ryan delegation was attacked on November 18th at an airstrip in Port Paituma near Jonestown. Ryan and four others were killed by Temple members wielding rifles and shotguns. So before all this, before they were all shot at, they actually went to Jonestown. Jim Jones let them all come in and, you know, they kind of were having almost like a celebration or welcoming him or whatever. And Ryan, you know, made a speech and, you know, he's saying something like, well, you know, I'm here to just kind of see what's happening. And I don't know, hopefully we can work together, whatever. And that's when the people started passing notes.
That's when that happened. Okay.
Yeah. That's when that happened. That's when people started passing notes to the people on the delegation, the reporters, whoever was there, saying, you know, we want to leave, you know, we want to get out of here. Interestingly, three of Joan's older sons weren't there that day for some reason.
Oh, there's a Jonestown basketball team. That was the most bizarre part. So the Jonestown basketball team was gone.
Yeah, they were spared because there was a tournament.
But I'm like, where? Who are you playing against? Another cult group?
Who are you playing?
Do you know what I mean?
Other cults in the area? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No.
Yeah.
Very weird. So as you know, so okay, so the congressional delegation leaves. I don't know. I'm not sure of the timing of all this, but it's kind of all happening at the same time. The delegation leaves, and Jim Jones, you know, they're like in one car or whatever. Jim Jones tells his, you know, his troops, you know, his people with guns, whatever you want to call them, his guards. He basically instructs them, you know, go kill all these people before they get on the plane. And so they all load up in a big truck with guns. And so the this plane is just on this airstrip. And on the other side of the airstrip is just all jungle. And so they're getting on the plane and they ambush them and they park their truck so that it's like on the other side of the plane so they can't run away. They can't run into the jungle. Although a couple people did escape.
Yes, yes. Because but five people died. So not everybody, Leo, right, you know, not everyone that was part of that group died.
No. Was it five or was it four?
Oh, total? I thought it was
four plus Ryan.
Four plus Ryan.
I don't know. Can't remember now. Terrible memory. So a couple people managed to escape into the jungle. But for the most part, like if you were going to run for the jungle, you're going to have to run past this truck with all these men shooting. And so they're shooting at them and some other people are exchanging fire. And, you know, Jackie Spears like hiding under the wheel well of the airplane. And she said she basically played dead, but someone walked up to her and shot her anyway a couple times.
And she survived all that. Wow.
Yeah, she survived. But yeah, I think it was Ryan and then I think three news reporters who died. And so then at the same time, Jim Jones is telling everybody back in Jonestown, well, you know, it's over. You know, like you said, you know, it's only a matter of time. Some of these people survive. They're going to tell someone what's happening and they're all going to come in here and kill us. So we're just going to have this mass suicide right now. And he tape recorded the whole thing. There's a whole, you know, it's like a couple hours or something where it's just, I've never heard it, but it's like, you know, children screaming.
It's awful. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause in some people like begging and pleading, and some of the people who were there managed to find places to hide.
Yeah. There were some stories of like one person, like someone very, one of the older people like went to their bedroom and fell asleep. I mean, you know, and slept through the whole thing and managed to escape it. And yeah, some people were able to hide and escape it. But yeah, the other thing was that Jim Jones was having all these drills, you know, for them. We're like, okay, this is it. It was called like white nights or white lights, white nights, you know, it's happening. It's happening. And so there was talk of some people wondering, oh, is this a fake? Right. Are we just, cause there was all this prep for, okay, when it's time for us all to kill ourselves, right? Like we're all going to get this drink, right? And we're all going to drink it. And it had been these drills up till now. So no one knew if it was real or not. And so, you know, obviously, right, this phrase, drink the Kool-Aid, is from Jim Jones in this situation, this mass. I don't know enough about Waco and is it David Koresh, but he must have taken a lot of his beliefs from Jim Jones, right? Because it's essentially the same thing that happened. Am I getting that confused with something else?
Well, in terms of what his cult espoused, I think it was somewhat different. He was more of like one of those, people who like, you know, the federal government is trying to kill us and, you know, different philosophies. But I mean, all cult leaders have these things in common, of, you know, how they operate. But I was going to say that in this tape, the audio tape that they have of this whole thing, Jones is going on and on about Tim Stone. Mm. Like he's blaming this all on Tim Stone. He's saying, if some people here are prepared and know how to do that, to go into town and get Tim Stone, but there's no plane. You can't, I mean, he's kind of like out of it.
I'm very high. Yeah.
Yeah. And, he's saying it's suicide. Plenty have done it. Stone has done it. But somebody ought to live, someone they can talk to. And I've talked to San Francisco. See that Stone does not get by with this infamy, So he's just rambling on and he's, keeps bringing up Tim Stone. And I mean, he's not wrong. He did bring him down.
Yeah.
You know, really. Because something would have eventually brought him down. He couldn't have gone on like this forever, but.
Yeah. There was also, you know, the reports of abuse had been there for a long time, of not only the financial abuse, but of, you know, this having sex with men and women. I don't think everybody consented, and that there was abuse of children. There was, the human rights violations was the fact that, you know, these people were being working 12, 13, 14 hours a day and not being fed anything. And obviously not, you know, and then not being able to leave is a big one.
Yeah. That is a big one.
So, you know, Jones had a lot of these, he was a trendsetter in some ways. And in the many ways, other ways, he was just like any other cult leader, any other person that came along. But definitely from hearing Jones's childhood, he was going to do something like this. Not necessarily this, but his life was not ever going to be on a great trajectory. Like that's that whole, because I think that there was something off very, very, very early on. And I do wonder, that's, again, comes back to this nature versus nurture. Was it the neglect and, you know, not having parents that cared about you or cared about your well-being, or was it, you know, something that you were born with? Because it seemed like it was this perfect storm of both together that created him.
Yeah, I wonder how his siblings fared in life.
Well, and that's the thing. I was reading stuff and I didn't hear anything about siblings.
I thought I read that he had siblings because he would talk. There was something about how they were so poor that sometimes he and his siblings didn't have clothes. Yeah. Like they were literally walking around town with no clothes on, and people would have to bring them in and give them clothes. And, you know, it was only by the kindness of strangers that these kids survived. I don't know what their mother was doing. I mean, it's one thing to be like, yeah, I'm not really very maternal, but I mean, what in the hell was she doing?
Yeah. Well, kids are not. I don't know. I'm not seeing siblings, but found this giant family tree for Jim Jones. Jim Jones himself had a lot of children. So some were adopted, some not so much. I'm not seeing.
That was another thing. You know, he and his wife, they began adopting interracial, children. I think he and his wife had the first interracial adoption.
Yes. Indiana. They were the first white family to adopt a black child in Indiana. Yeah. He adopted, I think he had a few kids from Korea that he adopted. Another child who I think was part Cherokee. Jim Jones also claimed to be part Cherokee, which no one's ever been able to corroborate that. What else? But I'm trying to remember some of the things that Dad told us about how, I guess, Dad thought he was full of shit from the beginning, that Dad's secretary I guess, at the, she was part of the People's Temple, and he didn't realize that. And I guess he made some comments about Jim Jones in the temple in front of her many times.
Yeah, he's lucky he didn't get whacked for that.
So, and that Jones, they would have these board meetings right there in downtown San Francisco. In downtown Ukiah. And apparently Jones would sometimes come. Sometimes he would come. Sometimes he wouldn't come. But that he would have to leave many times to take phone calls in the other room. Which makes no sense because, you know, this was before cell phones and all of that. So you had to have someone call a landline and then have that person, you know, have you. So you can tell right then and there that Jones needed people to know that he was special and important. If you're orchestrating someone to call you during a meeting so that you then have to get up and leave the meeting.
Yeah, no, he was there. We've only scratched the surface here. I mean, he was really something. And yeah, and really changed the history of that area, you know. It wasn't good for
didn't make the area look good,
and it you know, hurt a lot of people, you know, ruined a lot of people's lives, and you know.
Yeah. And then mom told me that, I guess everyone gets recruited in some way, shape or form. Right. I mean, that she was trying to get recruited, that she never really had too many interactions with Jim Jones, but that somewhat like Tim Stowen, I think, approached her or wrote her a letter and tried to get her involved, tried to get her, you know, to join. So there was like active, I can't imagine living there with all this active recruitment of having to like, oh my God, these people keep trying to recruit me.
Yeah.
That would have been, I mean, I guess you didn't know how scary it was, but that's frightening to think about. It's just frightening to think about if our parents had been, I don't know, feeling a little low, despondent in their lives, or dad decided, you know what I mean? If they were different people, we could have very easily ended up there.
Yeah. I mean, anyone who was around there who was vulnerable and susceptible.
But we luckily have a father who thinks everyone's full of shit. So
he's very anti-establishment, anything.
And anti-religion. He doesn't believe in God, and, you know, he doesn't want to hear anything. So Jim Jones was never going to recruit him. Wrong audience. But thank God. Thanks.
Yes.
Or there is no God. That's right. Thank you that our father thinks everyone is full of shit all the time and doesn't want to join. He's not a joiner, I should say. He's not a group joiner. So hence why we're here.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
I don't know. It's true. It's hard. There's so much, but he very much, I mean, when you think about the mass suicides and drinking the Kool-Aid and how much he has impacted, you know, our culture and how we see cults and how we see these religious sects. And you're absolutely right, which unfortunately, I mean, you know, Mendocino County is a beautiful place, and he really did taint it because.
Yeah. Well, and you know, also, when they refer to it as a mass suicide, what, you know, from some things I've seen is that, you know, they were people who weren't being compliant, because a lot of people.
Yeah, that's what I was saying, that they were shot.
They would shoot them.
So either you take the meds, you get shot, or you were injected with the cyanide, or you're shot.
Yeah. And that, you know, when you see scenes from that, you just see all these bodies piled up on top of one another. And I always looked at that and thought, well, how did this work? But no, it was because they were shooting people and stacking up the bodies. Mm-hmm. Because if everyone had just independently committed suicide, there'd be one person here, one person here. It wouldn't be stacked up. So I would imagine that the majority of those people, you know, didn't do this voluntarily. Mm-hmm. And
that's just a total. Yeah, I get the sense that by the time people got to Guyana, that they were so, I don't know, I wonder how much people were invested or just trying to make it hour by hour, you know, that.
Yeah, they were probably terrified. Yeah. I mean, things were just probably getting, I mean, it was not the utopia.
Yes, that he promised.
That he promised, and things are getting worse. And now all of a sudden, all this stuff is happening. And oh, it's very frightening.
Yeah. But you had said, did you say this before we started recording, that the majority of the people that died were Black women?
Oh, yeah. It was like 75% of the people who died were Black. And the majority of that were women. And there were other, you know, minority victims. But it was not, I think there was only like 20% white people. And yeah, he recruited a lot. Well, Dad was saying he would recruit a lot from San Francisco, you know, even when they were in Ukiah, you know, he'd go down there, recruit people, bring them up to Mendocino County and promise them, you know, oh, you know, it's utopia.
Yeah, it's great life.
It's going to be great, you know, and we'll take care of you, you know, and, you know, you won't have to pay anything.
You'll be so happy.
You'd just be so happy. But, you know, little did they know.
Yeah. And then, you know, and then that was the thing. That's why, right, some of the quote unquote good work that he did for the civil rights movement, right, there's this flip side of the fact that he would exploit people. Yeah. So, what a story.
All right. Well, that's a lot.
All right. Okay. Let's wrap it up.
Thanks for tuning in. If you haven't already subscribed, please subscribe to the podcast and leave us a 5-star review. We now have a Patreon. If you want more of us,
I mean, who would not want more of this?
You can go on patreon.com/
Psych Legal Pop.
You can check out what you get for joining the Patreon. And we're also on social media, Instagram and TikTok at Psych Legal Pop. And if you want to send us a message, we are at psychlegalpoppodcast@gmail.com.
Yep, that's everything.
All right.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.